Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's September 22nd. Last time, I think you had a test, right? You had a test? Really good. Hope you had a good weekend. I probably studied because there are practicums this week, if I look at the schedule. So here's the schedule. 22nd, yep, both the Monday and Wednesday labs have a practicum this week. And then don't forget, you got a lab after that. We're going to finish up the axial skeleton in lab, which is what we're going to talk about today. So today's a really good primer for what you have to do right after the practicum. Has anybody got a question over the schedule? You're good? Yeah, hi.
I'm on the grade book.
Yeah? Okay, the online quiz? Okay, that Blackboard grades the online quiz automatically. As soon as you hit submit, it's graded. Probably before you can even go and look. So that should be, it should automatically be transferred into your grade book. And so, did it get transferred to your grade book or what? It says
well,
that.
How many,
the lecture exam?
Well,
or the quiz?
I don't know, the whole grade book.
The whole grade book. Yeah, you should have some grades populating in there.
Yeah.
Maybe you should see me right after class, okay? Okay. When's your practicum today? Oh, well, okay, see me after lab then, maybe for a little bit, if you need to study. Okay, yeah, we need to check out and see what's going on there. I don't know. All right, so that's the schedule. That all is looking pretty good. And so let's start looking at axial skeleton. Axial skeleton. All right, so on the left-hand slide, you get the word slide that I'm going to work off of, and then on the right, we got typical pictures that we're going to look at. And of course, if you look at the pictures, you see how many colors that make up that skeleton. Yeah, there are two. And that just represents the two major parts of the skeleton. Right, we can break the whole skeleton down into axial skeleton and appendicular skeleton. Appendicular just means your arm and forearm, your thigh and leg, right, plus hands and feet. That's the appendicular skeleton. And then the axial skeleton are all the bones that are attached to the appendages, right? And they form this axis, including the skull, vertebral column, sternum, and ribs, right? So skull, ribs, sternum, and vertebral column make up the axial skeleton. In lab, we've covered the skull already, but we'll look at some of the skull today once again. Okay, so here, before we start looking at these things, right, there's a posterior view of the skeleton. We got to know some bone terminology, and I think some of you have learned a lot of this stuff already because we've had a quiz on the skull, human skull, last week. Right, but a raised rough spot on a bone, almost always used for muscle attachment, right? It is called a process. So a process is a rough raised area on a bone. And some of these names, some of these processes have special names because where they're located or the muscles that they attach to. Tubercles, tuberosity, trochanter, epicondyle, malleolus, crest, spine, and line. All of these things are processes. And so a muscle is going to attach to one of these spots. And if it's a muscle, then it's a tendon that attaches to the bone. If it's another bone that attaches here, then it's going to be a ligament, right? So bone-to-bone connection is a ligament. Muscle-to-bone is a tendon. So a trochanter is just a very big, massive process on the femur. Epicondyle is a raised, rough area that is right above a condyle. And remember, a condyle is an articulating surface. A crest is an elongated ridge on a bone. And a spine is a very short process, long and narrow, sticking off of a bone, but still for muscle attachment. And a line is like a crest. It's long, but it's not nearly as tall, right? You can just perceive there to be a small process moving all the way across the bone. That's a line. So all of these things are going to be processes, right? A depression, got a couple different names for depression. The most common is a fossa. And all of these things are used for holding something. So you could consider these things bowls. But some bowls are elongated, right? And so if it's an elongated fossa, we call that a sulcus. And another name for sulcus is groove. Sulcus and groove can be used pretty much all the time interchangeably. They're synonyms of each other. And an alveolus is a spot, for instance, that the root of a tooth attaches within the maxilla or mandible. And so it just, it's a very deep, narrow fossa. So we call it an alveolus. Right? And you know what a hole in a bone is called, typically? It is called a foramen. And if there are many, then of course plural is foramina, like for instance the olfactory foramina. A meatus is kind of like in between a hole and a fossa. A meatus is that depression in the temporal bone, both on the exterior and interior side, that have to do with hearing and balance. A canal is a fossa, but it's very long and narrow. So it's not just a simple hole in a bone. So it's like a tunnel going through the bone. Maybe it makes a bend inside the bone, or maybe the bone is really thick. But in any case, it's a fossa. A fissure is a foramen, but it's elongated. It's long and narrow, but it's still a hole in the bone. And I put sinus, right? And a sinus is not used for passageway, but it's a cavity deep inside of a bone. And so it's not really a passageway, it's for holding something. And what it holds is lymphatic tissue. Tissue that fights infection. And so some sinuses that I think of would be the sinus in the maxillary bone or the frontal bone or sphenoid bone. Those are paranasal sinuses, and their job is to fight infection, protect our bodies from pathogens that are trying to enter through our nose and our mouth. Those are some sinuses. So sinus, you can't see usually from the exterior of the bone. Usually you got to cut a bone open to see these sinuses. Okay, another important part of a bone is going to be a very smooth surface. And these things you can palpate with your fingertip. A process is going to be rough because something attaches there with a lot of connective tissue, like dense regular connective tissue. Right? But a joint or an articulating surface is going to be very smooth because that's where two bones are going to rub together. They're going to move. That's what we call an articulation. So these are going to be really smooth surfaces that you can feel with your fingertip. So a raised area that's smooth is what we call a condyle. We'll see some condyles pretty soon. And if it's on the end of a bone, if we have a condyle on an end of a long bone, sometimes we call that the head, right? A raised smooth area or head of a long bone. And you could also then tell me what's the function of a head on a long bone. It is for articulation. Yeah, it forms a joint. A facet is not a raised area, but it's a concave area. It's a depression. Almost looks like a fossa. And as a matter of fact, a couple of them are actually called fossa. And so a facet is a depression, but nonetheless, it's still smooth and it's there for articulation. And there are a couple special ones that we need to look at. All right, so these are condyles. They're called the trochlea and capitulum. They help make up the elbow, and these are smooth surfaces on the distal end of the humerus. So here is where we're going to find the trochlea and capitulum, but we're not going to talk about them specifically today. But they are examples of condyles. And then you ran into this for the skull, a ramus. A ramus is a piece of a bone that comes off the major part of the bone. Sometimes that major part we call the body. And if it makes a 90-degree bend off of the body, then we call it a ramus. And as a matter of fact, maybe if there's a branch coming off of a nerve that makes a 90-degree bend, we would call that a ramus as well. Yeah. My mic went away? Uh-oh. What light is that? Is that green or red? That's not a good sign. Okay, my mic went off. Maybe I can get it back working again. I think so. All right, so those are important features of a bone that you should be familiar with because we're going to use that terminology all the time. Probably more important is you should know what the function of each of those features is, right? For muscle attachment or a fossa for holding something or a passageway. or for making an articulation, like a condyle. Right? So I think it's good for you to know that kind of stuff. All right, I think I'm going to have my microphone back really quick. Okay, it should be back really soon. Is there? You can hear me now? Back there? Oh, good. Okay. All right. Woo, was that smooth or what? That was pretty fast. Okay. So, departing from these special features, special markings that we find on bones, getting back to the skeleton, all right, we're going to first today look at axial skeleton, and we know it's made of the skull, hyoid bone, vertebral column, and thoracic cage. Ooh, I forgot to mention hyoid bone. And is that something that you should know for the practicum this week, hyoid bone? Yes, it is, right? The vertebral column and thoracic cage, you're not responsible for, but the skull and hyoid bone, because the hyoid bone really is associated with the skull. It's just tucked up within the mandibular region, right? Kind of looks like a small mandible. Okay, and then just for the purpose of covering bases, I put the appendicular skeleton here, arms, legs, and girdles. We're going to cover this next time. All right, so we're not going to talk about the appendicular skeleton. That's why I put it in parentheses. All right, what about the skull? There are 8 cranial bones. It's got a pretty nice picture. If we look at the skull, we can break all the bones of the skull down into 2 main compartments. So there are bones that help protect the brain, that make the cranial vault. So we call these cranial bones. And then bones that are necessary for articulation, for eating, breathing, things like that, we call these facial bones. So these 2 areas. And so you should probably know the names of all of the cranial bones. Here's that list. All right, so we got parietal, temporal, ethmoid, occipital, sphenoid, frontal. I'm sure you're all familiar with those. Here is one that maybe you're not familiar with, a Wormian bone. Sometimes within a suture, there is going to be a very small bone. So here is a suture. Here's a lambdoidal suture. Here is a bone. It's not really part of the parietal, not really part of the occipital, but it's right between the two. So sometimes we call that a Wormian bone, Wormian. And they're just highly variable, where they develop, or somebody might not even have any of these kinds of bones in their skull. And the facial bones are the vomer, nasal, and mandible, zygomatic, palatine, lacrimal, and maxilla. So the mandible and maxilla, you can consider those your jaw bones. They have alveoli so that teeth can fit into that alveolus. Yeah. Yes, only within sutures. Only within sutures. Okay. We might have some other funny bones here and there. We call sesamoid bones, but these Wormian ones, sometimes they're called sutural bones as well. So Wormian and sutural. And sutural actually is a little bit more descriptive. It tells you where you find them. You always find them in a suture, right? Okay. All right. So there's a special connection between some of these bones that make up the cranium and some that make up the face. Like, for instance, the nasal septum is made partly of the vomer, but also partly of the ethmoid bone come together, right, to make the nasal septum. The temporal bone and the mandible come together, right, to make the temporomandibular joint. And as a matter of fact, the temporomandibular joint, or TMJ, is the only movable joint in our skull. So, all right, so here is that temporomandibular joint. And I can't really see the ethmoid very well, but here's a little piece of it. And down over here is going to be the vomer. They join together to make the nasal septum. Then there's a couple other bones that I got to mention. We won't study these until we get to the sensation chapter. These are tiny little bones. They're called auditory ossicles. You have 3 on one side, 3 on the other, and you find them in the petrous region of the temporal bone. Who can tell me where that petrous region is in the temporal bone? How would you look for that? It's been between the external acoustic meatus and internal acoustic, I can't put my finger there, internal acoustic meatus. Yeah, it's part of the temporal bone, and there's these 3 little bones in there, and they're very important. They articulate with each other, and they help transmit sound pressure waves into our sense organ for hearing. And as a matter of fact, they're so small, I could tell you that I have all three of these bones between my thumb and my finger right here, right? And nobody could say I don't, because they're so small, they would just fit right in there. Okay, they're really, really small. They're called auditory ossicles. So remember, anytime you hear this word osteo, you should think of bone. And they have to do with hearing, and hence we say auditory. Some other bones, the hyoid bone that we mentioned, and then there's some bones in the nasal cavity, the nasal conche, and those are important because they're covered with a mucous membrane, so when you breathe in really dehydrated air or dry air, they help humidify the air, so that by the time it gets into your lungs, it's humidified, so that dry air doesn't turn your lungs into potato chips, because your lungs are pretty delicate tissue. And if the air is really hot, it helps cool the air down so that you don't burn your lungs. And if it's really cold, it helps warm the air up so you don't freeze your lungs. So those are all pretty important features. Cavities. So we have the cranial cavity that holds the brain. We have a nasal cavity that's an air passageway. Oral cavity, right, that's our mouth. And then here are four other kinds of cavities. The paranasal sinuses. So these are big cavities with inside bones, and they contain lymphatic tissue. There's some in the sphenoid bone, there's one in the maxilla, a couple in the frontal, and a couple in the ethmoid bone. So this is where we find those paranasal sinuses. All right, so let me look and see about what I would like to show you. All right, so the cranial fossa. So we're looking down into the cranium, and we've taken the skull cap off. Sometimes we call the skull cap the calvarium, right? And just an artificial bone, and you have those in lab. You just lift the top of the skull off, and we can look down into the cranial vault. And I see a number of foramina, but I also see three main fossa. All right, so here is the anterior cranial fossa. Here's the middle cranial fossa, and then here's the posterior cranial fossa. And what's the function of a fossa, once again? Holding something, right. So the anterior cranial fossa helps hold the frontal lobes of the brain, right? And you don't have to know that for the bone chapter, I don't think, but when we get to brain, it's going to make a whole lot more sense for you. The middle cranial fossa holds the temporal lobes, and then this posterior cranial fossa holds what lobe of the brain? Even though we haven't studied brain just yet, you know the name of this bone, and that's why knowing bones is so important, because you learn so much other kind of stuff. Take a guess at what lobe of the brain is right up here, held in the posterior cranial fossa, mostly made by the occipital bone. That is going to be the occipital lobe. Right, so indeed these are fossa for holding something. Okay, so here is that nasal septum that we were talking about. The vomer makes the inferior part, and the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid bone makes the superior part. So the nasal cavity is broken down into these chambers, and that helps make sure that air flows in and out of our body really smoothly. It sort of almost acts like an airplane wing, so that air flows in smoothly. It doesn't flow in with a lot of turbulence. And the same thing for these nasal concha. It just orders the air so they can smoothly flow in and out of your lungs. So this middle concha and the superior, which I don't really see on this diagram, are part of the ethmoid bone, but this inferior nasal concha is a bone all by itself. It's a standalone bone. And it's associated with the palatine bones. Palatine bones help make up the roof of the mouth and the sides, the vertical sides of the nasal cavity. Those are the palatine bones. So this is a pretty good view. So I see some cavities right here. I see some holes in the ethmoid bone here and here and here and here. What do we call these things? What do we call these? What do you call these? I hear somebody's taking a good stab at it, but I don't quite hear you. These are the paranasal sinuses, right? So this is a nasal sinus in the ethmoid bone, which is what we have over here, right? So Ethmoid bone does have paranasal sinuses, and we can see them right there. What else do I want to say about the cranium? I think we spent a lot of time already in lab on the cranium, cranial bones. So I think that's really all I want to say about cranial bones. All right, so then let's move on to the rest of the axial skeleton. Like, for instance, the vertebral column. Here are a bunch of vertebrae, and they're all joined together. So there is a special kind of articulation between the vertebrae. And the vertebral column is broken down into some main areas. The most superior part is what we call the cervical region. Right? And then the one right below that is called the thoracic region. And below that is lumbar, and then sacral, and then coccygeal vertebrae make up these different regions. And I would like for you to know how many vertebrae are in each of these divisions, and of course where the divisions are. Because when we name one of these vertebrae, in most cases we just have to say what the region is that they belong in, and then what number from superior to inferior. So if I were to ask you how many thoracic vertebrae are there, you would say there are 12, right? In an absolutely normal individual, there might be some variation. Somebody might have 11 in here, right? Probably not 13, but there's some anatomic variation, but most of us have 12 vertebrae. And how many in the cervical region? You see 7, and lumbar region has 5. There's not too much variation in the lumbar region from person to person that I've ever seen. All right, so what makes these things different? Well, mostly it's because of these thoracic vertebrae. In order to be a thoracic vertebrae, there has to be a rib attached to it, right? And if there's a rib attached to it, it helps make the thoracic cavity. So a thoracic vertebrae has to have a rib to it. So how many pairs of ribs do you have? Yeah, it's got to be a one-to-one correspondence. So you have 12 pairs of ribs, one on the right, one on the left. So we're going to see that. And so there are some markings on these bones where that rib attaches. And so some of these bones, well, at least in the thoracic region, have some markings that we don't find in the cervical region or lumbar region. All right, so how are you going to remember that there's 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, and 5 lumbar? It's kind of a fun little thing to say. Okay, think about meal times. When do you have breakfast? 7 o'clock in the morning. Just pretend you do. 7 o'clock, you have breakfast. When do you have lunch? At 12 o'clock, right? And when do you have dinner? 5 o'clock. So that's a pretty easy way for most people to remember that 7, 12, and 5 represent the number of vertebrae in each of these different divisions. Sometimes we call this a level, right? Usually I talk about it in terms of a division. Other instructors might call this the thoracic level or lumbar level. There's different ways that we can talk about it. Okay, and in the sacrum, we usually have 5, but these are kind of special because all of these vertebrae are fused together. There's not a movable joint. So the joint between T6 and T7, that's a movable joint, right? So you can rotate on that joint just a little bit. So notice, when we talk about these different vertebrae, we don't always say cervical vertebrae number 4. We can just say C4. Right? Or C6 or C7. Do we ever want to say C12? No, because there's no such thing, right? But if we want to talk about this one here, then this would be T12, corresponding to the 12th thoracic vertebrae. But how do we know this is a thoracic vertebrae if we had the whole skeleton right here? You would see a rib attached to it, right? The very last rib. Okay. Then the lumbar vertebrae, no ribs attached to them, and we'll look at some characteristics of lumbar vertebrae, but because they're the most inferior, they're holding up more weight than the cervical region. Right? What do the cervical vertebrae hold up? Your head, which is kind of heavy, so the bodies of these vertebrae are pretty strong, but not nearly as strong as the lumbar vertebrae because they're not only holding up your head, they're holding up the rest of your body too. So these are very, very big, strong bones. Okay. I see some curvatures when we look at the vertebral column. And especially on a lateral view, we see some curvatures, and these are normal. So we see this concave curvature, looking from the posterior, concave, there's a little bend in, right? And this helps position your head a little bit anterior to the other parts of your body, right? So that holds your head right on midline. Because if it was back over here, if it was a straight vertebral column, remember your vertebral column is very posterior in your body, and if the vertebral column went straight up, then where would your head be? Would be way back behind you, and you wouldn't have good weight distribution, right? So it's a lot easier if your head is positioned in the center of your body. All right, but now here is the thoracic curvature, and you can see that it is convex. And that's convex because you have important organs in this area. And so it has to make space for important organs, like, for instance, your lungs and your heart. It needs extra space in this region, and the vertebral column, right, allows for that to happen, right? But then to realign that weight back over your body, we have this lumbar curvature, so that brings some of the distribution of your weight back anterior so that you don't fall backwards. And then look at this curvature at the sacrum and the coccyx. We call that the sacral curvature. And again, why do we have this thoracic curvature? To accommodate organs, thoracic organs. And guess why we have this sacral curvature? To accommodate organs in the pelvis. Yeah, pelvic organs. Okay, uterus, large intestine, bladder, things like that in the pelvic cavity. All right, so these are all normal curvatures. So let's take a look at what a typical vertebrae is. So here's a typical vertebrae. The big massive part that supports a lot of weight is what we call the body. Sometimes we can call that the centrum. You could call it centrum or body. It's big and thick, right? Supports a lot of weight. And then there's a bony plate that comes off the body right here, and this is what we call the pedicle. And then there's another bony plate that comes off the pedicle. We call that the lamina. Right, so we got a pedicle, lamina, another lamina, and another pedicle. When these things all join together and attach to the body, we call that the vertebral arch. All right, so here's a hole in this vertebrae. And of course, a hole is a foramen. And this is what the spinal cord moves through. So here is the vertebral foramen. Spinal cord is going up and down through the vertebral column, through this hole. Attached to these lamina and pedicles, we have a nice process. Look at how rough it is. I can see some roughness here, some roughness over here. This is a long and narrow process, and there are a lot of muscles that attach right here. They're sort of in the transverse plane, so we call these the transverse processes for muscle attachment. But in the thoracic region, they're also going to attach to take a guess, what else are they going to attach to besides muscles in the thoracic region? Ribs, yeah. And here is a little smooth area. This is a facet for where it articulates with the rib. Here's another one over here. This can articulate with the head of a rib. Okay, so these are the transverse processes. And then here is going to be one that's really long and narrow. What do we call a long and narrow process? We call it a spine, right? So spine. So here's what we call the spinous process. And again, that's for muscle attachment. So all of these muscles around the back help stabilize the back and protect the vertebral column. There's a process sticking off of the pedicles superiorly, and I can see another smooth articulating surface. All right, so this is going to articulate with the vertebrae that's right above it. And we're going to see that there's a process down below as well that will articulate with a vertebrae down below it. Maybe I'll try and find an example of those things. Can I find that right now? Yeah, pretty much. Okay, so here is that superior articulating process. There's the facet on it. And, well, it's kind of hidden. It's behind this rib over here. What about this view? Ah, perfect. All right, so here I see two vertebrae, and here is the process for articulating with the vertebrae above it, and then here is the articulating surface or facet. Here is the process, we call that the inferior articulating process because it articulates with the vertebra below it. And then here is the superior articulating process of the lower vertebrae that makes a nice joint right here. All right, what else do I see? Well, I see another facet on the transverse process. And this is for a rib. So a rib is going to articulate, so this has got to be a thoracic vertebrae. I'm not so sure I see much on this vertebrae right here, so I don't think I want to talk much about it. Oh, no, I do see something. I see something here, and I see something here. That's another articulating facet for the head of a rib. So if I see an articulation for a rib on this vertebra and this one here, what can you tell me about these two vertebrae? They are thoracic vertebrae. Okay. Okay. So in most cases, we just talk about, we name a vertebrae by what division it's in and what number. And I do want you to be able to recognize a cervical vertebrae from a thoracic, from a lumbar, from sacral, but you won't have to tell me what number it is, except in the cervical region. There are a couple in the cervical region that are really important, right? And that's C1 and C2. C1 and C2 you can refer to just like that, but they also have some special names. All right, so thinking about mythology, there's a god that holds up the whole world. Who's that? Who's that god that's holding up the whole world? You ever see a statue of somebody? Yeah, and the name of that god is Atlas. So the first cervical vertebrae is holding up your head. Reminded somebody of that god holding up the whole world. And so the name of the first vertebrae is also the Atlas. All right, so let's take a look at the Atlas. Here's a good look at it, right? So here is C1, otherwise known as Atlas. Is that on this slide? Oh yeah, it is labeled right here. Good, I'm glad. Okay, so what do we see? I see some transverse processes here and here. I see just a little bit of a spinous process, not too much of one. So sometimes we call that the posterior tubercle because it's for muscle attachment. We just don't have a lot of muscles attached there. Right, and then we've got the pedicle and lamina, right, form this vertebral arch. But what is missing from this particular vertebrae or vertebra? The body. We expect to see the body of the vertebrae right here, but it's missing. So this vertebrae has these long, narrow bones. So this is probably the most fragile vertebrae in your body. And fortunately, when it fractures, a lot of times it is a stable fracture. Because if a bone ever fractures and moves into the spinal cord at this level, that's probably immediately fatal when that happens. Right, so this can be fractured in car accidents and things like that. Mostly due to the kind of articulation. So here's the superior articulating facet. And can you tell me what bone is right above C1? Yeah, the occipital bone. And can you picture in your mind the articulating surface on the occipital bone that articulates right in here? It is the occipital condyle, right? It's kind of long and narrow. And what happens in this particular joint, right, is that your head can flex and extend. We haven't learned what that is yet in this class, but that's the yes motion, that's flexion and extension. That is allowed at this particular joint, but not rotation. If for some reason the occipital bone rotates up against this C1, that can produce a fracture in C1. Right? So only the yes motion because of the nature of these joints right here. All right, well, I'm curious to find out what happened to the body of C1, and we're going to find it. We're going to find it right here on C2. So here is the body of C1, and we can see that it is fused with the body of C2. So here's the body of C2. And then right on top of it is the body of C1. This is what we call the odontoid process or the dens. And this acts like an axle, right? So if you have a wheel and you want the wheel to spin, you put it on an axle. So this acts as an axle so that the joint between C1 and C2 allows for rotation. So what kind of motion is that? That no motion. Yeah, so no motion is between C1 and C2. Yes motion is between occipital bone and C1. And if any other kind of motion takes place, then usually that fractures these different vertebrae. All right, now, this joint right here, because of this dens, is sticking up, You'll have to look at it in lab. I don't have a good picture, right? A lateral view or anterior posterior view. I just have the superior view right here. It's like a fingertip pointing straight out. And if you flex and extend between C1 and C2, remember, that's not an allowed motion. A lot of times the dens will break off and it moves directly posterior into the spinal cord, right? And that is immediately fatal when that happens. So we do want you to know a lot about C1 and C2, right? And all of its little pieces. All right, what about another cervical vertebrae? I don't see, let's take a look at this. All right, so here is C1. And then here is the body of C1, but it's not attached to C1. Where is it attached to? C2. I can see it attached to C2. Here we have a nice transverse ligament that holds the odontoid process or the dens up against C1. And so the joint between C2 and C1 is a nice joint that allows for rotation. All right, so how are we going to figure out what is a cervical vertebrae and a thoracic vertebrae? And I can see a couple things right here. I can see at least one thing. Look at this spinous process on cervical vertebrae. Does it have one point or two? It's got two. All cervical vertebrae have two points coming back from the spinous process. We call that a bifid spinous process. Bifid meaning two. Bifurcated. Bifurcation is when something splits apart. So only cervical vertebrae have bifid spinous processes. When I look at C7 right here, I don't really see it from this particular view, but if we were to look from the underside, we would actually see two ridges, right? Two crests on the spinous process, which means that it would be a cervical vertebrae. Okay, some other things that a cervical vertebrae has is that there is a blood vessel that goes through all the spinous processes that brings blood to the brain. And since it goes through the vertebral column, we call that the vertebral artery. Very important artery bringing blood to the brain. There's only four arteries that supply blood to your whole brain. And that's two of them, one over here, one over here. And so let's see if we can find. Look at this. Here is the transverse foramen, right? And only cervical vertebrae have transverse foramina. And that's for that vertebral artery going up to the brain, right through your neck or cervical region. All right, so those are some things, the bifid spinous process and the transverse foramina will signify that it is a cervical vertebrae. For it to be a thoracic vertebrae, it has to have these transverse costal facets because there's a rib that's going to articulate there or a demifacet on the vertebral bodies. And sometimes you can't really see these things, but you can actually palpate them with your fingertips pretty easily. All right, another nice thing is that thoracic vertebrae never have a bifid spinous process. Spinous process for thoracic vertebrae is very long and narrow and angulates inferiorly. So that is a pretty good sign that this is a thoracic vertebrae. Lumbar vertebrae, on the other hand, don't have any facets on the transverse processes, right? Or on the bodies because ribs don't attach to a lumbar vertebrae. The spinous process is not long and narrow. It's more square shaped and it courses more straight posteriorly. It's not angled inferiorly at all. So that is one really good way to see the difference. And of course, did we see it to scale? Not really, because these are going to be a lot bigger than thoracic vertebrae. They almost look the same size. As a matter of fact, this thoracic vertebrae almost looks bigger on these two slides, but the lumbar vertebrae is going to be big, right? Because the bodies are massive for holding up all of that body weight. Okay, so here's that joint between bodies, and this is what we call intervertebral disc, and I think we've talked about this disc before. It is made up of cartilage. Can you remember what kind of cartilage? It's got to be tough. That's right. So fibrocartilage. Yeah, fibrocartilage is in here. Right? It's very similar to the meniscus that we have in our knees. So if we look at the intervertebral disc, we can see that here is the annulus fibrosus, which is made out of fibrocartilage, but there's also a center part to it, and a center part of something sometimes we call the nucleus, like the nucleus of a cell or nucleus of an atom. Right? And so here's the nucleus of an intervertebral disc. We call that the nucleus pulposus. And that is not fibrocartilage. Right? It actually is more like a pillow. It contains fluid. So that if there is damage to the annulus fibrosus, that fluid can try to squirt out. And here we can see that here's damage to the disc. Here's the normal side. And here's the spinal cord. And there are nerves that leave through this hole, and I'll show you where this hole is at the moment, and this nerve has very free exit to get through this hole, but look on this other side. Here that intervertebral disc is poking back into that hole and is pinching off this nerve, right? And that's going to damage this nerve. And it can be a motor nerve, which causes motion in your body, or it could be a sensory nerve for sensation. So somebody that has an intervertebral disc that is herniated, right, you might have one of those deficits or both. So if this is a nerve that goes down to your foot or leg, then you might have a lot of severe pain in your ankle or your leg, right? But there's no damage to your leg or your ankle. It is what? Damage way up here in the spinal cord due to this nerve that's being impinged upon by this herniated disc. Sacrum. Got to know something about the sacrum. Okay, so here's the sacrum. It's got five vertebrae, and they're fused together. Notice it no longer has any intervertebral discs. What has happened to these intervertebral discs? What process has occurred right here? What is the process when you have a bone that's only made out of cartilage, but it looks like the bone that's going to be there? Right? So you have this cartilage model of a bone, and then it turns into bone. What do we call that process? Ossification. That's right. So all of these lines of fusion, transverse lines of fusion, the intervertebral discs have undergone that ossification process, and so now it is solid bone, so that the body of S1 is now fused with S2 and S3, fused to S4. Right, and when I say S, that means what? The sacral division. Yeah, the sacral division. Okay, just for fun, here I see some coccygeal vertebrae. I don't think they really have any significance in the human. Right, so here would be coccygeal number 1, number 2, 3, 4. We never say coccygeal or write down coccygeal. How would we label this? Could I say this is C1? That doesn't make sense because C1 stands for cervical, right? So this vertebrae right here would be capital C, little O for coccygeal, all right, when it's written out in a report someplace. But we still have to say coccygeal when we're speaking to people about that. All right, here is something that kind of looks like a fan or a wing. A fan or a wing is what we call an ala. And there's one on the right, one on the left. And so these ala actually help make that fossa, that pelvic organs, fit in. There are a number of foramina that I see. So this is the anterior side of the sacrum because here are all the bodies. The bodies of vertebrae are anterior, not posterior. So there are nerves that leave the sacral canal. Here's the sacral canal. This matches up with the vertebral canal. So nerves come down into this region and either exit posteriorly or exit anteriorly. And so that's why we call these the anterior sacral foramina. And these are the posterior sacral foramina. And that's because there's nothing that really goes from posterior to anterior through this foramen, right? But there's something that's in the sacral canal that leaves posteriorly or anteriorly. So that's why we got a couple different names for these holes. Even though it looks like they go straight through, there's really nothing that goes right through the sacrum like that. What else do I see on the sacrum? Well, the line of fusion for S1, there's a very prominent lip right here. We call that the sacral promontory. So you'll notice that sticking out. Too bad I can't twirl this bone around. We'd be able to see it in a lateral view. And on this posterior view, we see some other things besides the posterior sacral foramina. We see this crest running right down midline on the sacrum. These are where all the spinous processes of the sacral vertebrae fuse together. So So we call this the median sacral crest. And then off to the side, we can see a lateral sacral crest here and here. And again, what's the function of this lateral sacral crest? It's a process. A crest is a process. It's for muscle attachment. Yeah, muscle attachment. And then I see a little bit smoother area right here and right here. This is for an articulation. And we don't really call it a condyle because it's more concave. We don't call it a facet because it's so big. We call it the auricular surface. Another way that maybe you could think of this, you could call that the articular surface. But people just say auricular because the bones that make up the pelvis articulate here, namely the hip bones. Now, the hip bones are not part of the axial skeleton, so we don't talk about it, but we'll look at it next time in class. The os coxae are the hip bones that attach here and here. All right, and then we can see that superior articulating process, and here's the facet. Now, what vertebrae is going to articulate right here on the superior articulating process of the sacrum? L5. Yeah, you should have a nice picture in your mind of that. Okay, so that's the sacrum. All right, let's look at the thoracic cage. All right, so I see some vertebrae right here. See the vertebrae? Now, is this anterior or posterior that we're looking at? Here's the body of a vertebrae. Anterior. Yeah, so remember, body is anterior. What's posterior on a vertebrae? What's posterior on a vertebra? It is a spinous process, right? And fortunately, you're the answer key for that question on the test, right? Because you can just feel your back. You can feel all those bumps, and all those bumps are the spinous processes. Pointing straight posteriorly. Oh, here's something I forgot to mention. Feel those spinous processes of your cervical vertebrae. I don't think you can tell that they're bifurcated because there's too much muscle around them. And then but just go down inferiorly, and then all of a sudden, you feel that bump. You got a hump right there. And you might be wondering, does that belong right there? And you know what? Everybody has that. Right? It just so happens that C7 has a very prominent spinous process. Where is that? And we call that the cervical prominence. What about here? Ah, here it is. Look at these spinous processes. Kind of short. And all of a sudden, C7 has a really long spinous process. And it like forms that little hump right there. And that's what we call the vertebra prominence or cervical prominence. And that is on C7. So that might be one way for you just to do some surface anatomy and figure out where C7 is on you. It's pretty easy to find. Okay, kind of reminds me of this lip right here on S1, right? But this one is anterior. The prominence, of course, is posterior. All right, so here is a vertebrae. What kind of vertebrae is this where I have the cursor? There's got to be a thoracic vertebrae because there's a rib attached to it, and that's just by definition. Okay, here is, in common language, we call this the breastbone. Right? But it's your sternum, and notice that the sternum has three pieces to it. And the superior one is what we call the manubrium, and then that's joined to the body. So this is an articulation, and it actually forms a little point, like an elongated point right there. We call that an angle, right? The sternal angle. And then hanging off the inferior part of the body, we have another bone called the xiphoid process. It looks like cartilage on this particular picture, but in us, it has ossified a long time ago, which means what? It's been turned into bone, right? So here is a little xiphosternal joint, and doesn't look very strong, and indeed, the xiphoid process can break off of the body fairly easily. That has some important clinical significance for all of us in here, and who could tell me why that little bone could be important? Yeah. 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 Okay, there are times when somebody's heart isn't beating, right? And they have very short time to live, maybe just a minute, something like that. So to help get blood to their brain, you can do compressions on their chest. Call that chest compressions. And that compresses the heart and it squirts a little bit of blood around their body. Not so much that they wake up or become conscious, but it might be enough blood to keep their brain from dying, right? So that's really important. So if you're doing chest compressions and they don't wake up and thank you, don't be surprised, right? Because they're not conscious, but you might be helping them tremendously just by keeping their brain alive. Just enough oxygen is getting there. All right, but where you do chest compressions is on the body of the sternum. If you do chest compressions on the xiphoid process, and you all probably can palpate your xiphoid process right here, okay, it can break off, and a fractured bone is very sharp. And that fractured bone can end up in the liver, or it can end up in the pericardium. If it ends up in the pericardium, pericardial cavity, what happens? It's going to cut something. What is it going to cut in the pericardial cavity? It's going to cut the heart, right? And maybe... I've never heard of putting a hole in the heart, but I suppose it could. Well, you can imagine that would be really bad to put a hole in somebody's heart. So instead of helping somebody, unfortunately, you're hurting them. Or if it moves over into the liver, right, that's going to cause massive hemorrhage as well. That won't help the person. All right, so you always find out where that xiphoid process is. Move up a couple finger widths above that and do your chest compressions on what part of the sternum? The body, right, the body of the sternum. All right, so you got this sternal angle. You can palpate this too on yourself, the jugular notch on the manubrium. Right, it's a nice depression. What you can't palpate, okay, are the clavicular notches very well, here and here. I don't think I can do that. Yeah, too much muscle. I can't really feel that right there. Okay. Okay, so jugular notch, clavicular notch, these are on the manubrium, right, specifically. All right. All right, so how many pairs of ribs do we have once again? Yeah, we got 12. All right, and posteriorly, the head of a rib articulates with the body of a vertebrae, and then there's going to be a rough area on a rib away from the head that articulates with the transverse process. You're going to see that's the tubercle. And then it courses all the way anteriorly, and some of them attach directly to the sternum via this hyaline cartilage. And so we call this costal cartilage. Costal means rib. So rib number one attaches directly to the sternum. What about rib number two? Directly or indirectly? Directly goes there. Number three? Directly attaches. Number four? Directly. Number five, look at that. It's still directly attaching to the sternum. So that's five. What about six? Yeah, it's still directly to the sternum. It's attached to other things, right? But it still goes to the sternum. And what about seven? It goes directly to the sternum. Even though six and seven almost look like they're fused together, it still goes directly. So the superior seven ribs are what we call true ribs because their costal cartilage goes directly to the sternum. Rib number eight has cartilage on it. So here's eight. So here's the costal cartilage. But does it go to the sternum? It doesn't make it all the way. It attaches to the costal cartilage of number seven. Right? And the same four. All right, so here is seven. All right, so eight, nine, ten. These are what we call false ribs because they don't attach directly to the sternum. What about these two ribs down over here, 11 and 12? Do they attach directly to the sternum?
No.
They do not. So they are false ribs as well. So all of these down here are false ribs, but 11 and 12 also have a special designation because they don't have any costal cartilage on them. So these we call floating ribs, right? So floating ribs are false ribs, but not all false ribs are floating, right? Most do have articulation via costal cartilage to the cartilage above it. All right, so that's the thoracic cage. Let's look at a rib. Here's a nice picture of a rib. This is the posterior part of the rib. Here's the anterior part. So this anterior part has a costal cartilage that goes to the sternum that we just looked at. This posterior part attaches to a vertebrae. So the tip of this bone is large, and it has articulating surfaces. Here are a couple little facets. There's a superior inferior one for articulating with the body of a vertebrae. And then there's a narrowing, right? And then another enlarged area. So if we're near the head of a bone, and then it becomes narrow and then large again, guess what we call that narrow part of the bone near the head? Then that's the neck, right? So here's the neck of a vertebrae. And This is a process. A tubercle is a process. So there are a lot of ligaments that help attach this bone to the transverse process of a vertebrae. Right. Then we have the costal angle, because this is going posteriorly or laterally, and then it makes this bend to go around anteriorly, and then it makes a nice right turn into midline to get to the sternum. So this is what we call the angle. Here's the shaft. This long part of a rib is a shaft, and then here's just an articulating surface for that costal cartilage. So a lung and heart is going to be in here, but blood needs to get, and actually nerves need to get from this posterior region through the thoracic cavity to the anterior part of your thoracic wall. So how do those nerves get there? How do those blood vessels get there? Well, they can't go across the lung, but they actually follow this rib. Do you see this little depression right here? What do we call a long depression in a bone? It's called a sulcus or a groove, and you could call it either one. So here is a costal groove or sulcus, and that just carries nerves and blood vessels into the anterior part of your body, this costal groove. Pretty much all ribs have these things. It might be difficult to see with your naked eye, so probably a good way to see it is just to palpate it with your fingertip first. And you'll see that, you'll feel that depression, right, in the rib, in the angle of a rib, and once you feel it, you look at it a little bit more carefully, and you go, oh, there is a costal groove right there. Right? So it's amazing how sensitive our fingertips are. What's the name of that corpuscle that's in our fingertips for that kind of sensation? That's a Meissner's corpuscle. Yeah, Meissner's corpuscle. Okay, so how does this rib articulate with a vertebrae? Well, because these vertebrae look like they're really strange shape, and this rib has a really strange shape. And in lab, I definitely want you to put these two things together to see how perfectly they match up. It's just amazing that they match up really nice. All right, so here is the body of a vertebrae. Here's the head of a rib, and you can see that here's that articulating surface of a rib articulating with the body of a vertebrae. And as a matter of fact, what kind of vertebrae is that? That's got to be a thoracic vertebrae, right? Sorry, I'm just beating that point to death. So here's a thoracic vertebrae. Here's the head of a rib, and then we got the neck, and then here's the tubercle of a rib, and then here's the articulating facet on the transverse process, transverse costal facet. And all these ribs just match up just perfectly to form this arch right before the angle, before it goes anteriorly. So this is how it matches up. So the body is important for that rib joint and the transverse process as well. Okay, so what part of the rib is this right here? That's the head. What's this other wide part? Tubercle, yep. And then this narrow part is the neck. So I don't know, a lot of times students think ribs are pretty simple, but it still has a couple pieces you got to know about, like this tubercle right here and the head. Okay. Well, I better take a look at my notes to see what I have. Oh, that's it, huh, for my notes? That's it? Just two little pages like that? The annulus fibrosus. Oh, a couple of curvatures that I can't really show you. Can I show you these? Okay, kyphosis, lordosis, scoliosis. I don't have a picture. All right, so these are lateral bends, right? Not anterior, posterior. You found it someplace? Ah, here. Here? Yeah, I just can't see the vertebral column very well. Okay, so here is an exaggerated, all right, thoracic curvature. And so let's see. What are these three that we want to look at? Okay, so lordosis, exaggerated lumbar curvature, okay, like what we see right here. Kyphosis is an exaggerated thoracic curvature. Not a correct medical term, right, but somebody would call that a hunchback, right? A scoliosis is a lateral curvature, usually in the lumbar region. I don't have a nice anterior posterior view of the vertebral column. Now there is a normal curvature which is not scoliosis, it's a lateral curvature, and where is it going to be? Let's find that nice vertebral column, It's right here, right here. Oh, here's a lateral view, okay. So here is a nice anterior view, and I can see that this vertebral column is pretty much straight vertical, so I don't see any scoliosis here. But in us, all right, we do have the spinal cord moving out over to the right and then back toward midline. All right, so there's going to be indentation on the left, right in this region here. Right, and so like the pelvic and thoracic curvature is there to accommodate organs, the same thing for that bending to the right of the vertebral column in this region. Can somebody guess why we have that bending, the right bending of the vertebral column in this region right here? Because you have to have space for your heart right there. Right? So you're going to notice that in lab as well. This is an important point in lab. Right, so how do these bones of the skull form? As a matter of fact, what are the two ways that bone formation takes place? The two main ways. Endochondrial or intramembranous ossification, right? And so these flat bones of the skull form from intramembranous ossification. So they were all membranes at one point in time. And of course, a membrane is not strong like bone whatsoever. And here are some ossification centers. And then these membranes start to fill in with more and more bone. But by the time a fetus is born to become a neonate, there are still places where there is membrane and not bone, not cranial bones. And these things commonly, what do we call these things commonly? Soft spots. Right, and the correct anatomical term is fontanelle, and fontanelle can be spelled differently. Here it's kind of fancy, fontanelle, E-L-L-E, but it can also be just E-L. Either one is fine. And so it's a point of some jeopardy to the neonate because there's not bone. It's a very delicate tissue, so it's very susceptible to puncture wounds, but also any kind of twisting or sliding of these bone plates can damage the skull and the brain right underneath it. So shaking or twisting or throwing a baby up in the air and catching it, I always kind of cringe, because these soft spots can last up to 2 years in a newborn. Right now, since it puts the neonate in jeopardy, there's got to be a reason why they're there. What's a good reason to have these soft spots? Because right after you're born, your brain grows very, very rapidly, much faster than bone can grow. And so these fontanelles allow for expansion of the cranial vault, which then allows for the correct development of the brain. And another reason is during parturition or childbirth, right, this cranium right here has to squeeze through the birth canal, and these membranes here allow deformation of the cranium so that it makes delivery a little bit easier. So how many do we have? We've got four of these that we want to be familiar with. In the front, we have the anterior fontanelle, right, mostly between the parietal and frontal bones. Then we have a posterior fontanelle between the parietal and the occipital. But then we got some lateral as well. This one is pretty easy. That's a sphenoidal fontanelle. That's where the sphenoid is going to help fill in. And then here, right, it's not named after a bone, but it's named after the mastoid process. So here's the mastoidal fontanelle. Right. All right, so I think that's pretty much all I want to say. Did I talk about the nasal sinuses? Maybe I need to say just a little bit about a nasal sinus. You have a pretty good picture in your book of where they are. I don't see it. Ah, I do see it. Okay, so on the word slide, how many paranasal sinuses did I write down, did I mention? Yeah, there's four. All right, let's look at a couple of big ones. Anteriorly, here is a big, huge one in the maxilla. So this is the maxillary paranasal sinus. Underneath the glabella, we have the sinuses in the frontal bone. So we call that the frontal paranasal sinus. And then there are some in the ethmoid bone. Remember, that's right smack on midline. And then also there's a big cavity in the sphenoid bone, which is posterior to the ethmoid. So we can see all four. And then with a little bit different view, a lateral view, right, we can see the frontal, the maxillary, sphenoid way in the back, and all these smaller ones in the ethmoid. Okay, that's pretty good. I tell you what, I do want to look at one last thing. I don't know which figure I like better. Probably this one. All right, so could you tell me, what bone, where do I have the cursor right now? That's the ethmoid bone. And there is something that's poking up into the cranium. Right here kind of looks like a shark's tooth. That's the crista galli. And then perpendicular to the crista galli, we have these bony plates of the ethmoid bone. This is what we call the cribriform plate. And the cribriform plate, you can see, has all these perforations. What do we call all these perforations? The olfactory foramina, right? Because the ethmoid bone helps make up the nasal cavity. And so olfactory nerves go through the cribriform plate into the nasal cavity for the sense of olfaction, which is smell, right? All right, so we've got olfactory foramina. Then right behind that, we've got the optic canal, right? And then we've got a line of three foramina, rotundum, ovale, spinosum. Rotundum is round, ovale is oval. Lacerum is in this region. Right, and then we've got the internal acoustic meatus, a big jugular foramen, and then even, and all of these foramina that we've talked about so far are bilateral, so you have at least two of them, except for this one, foramen magnum. Right, that is where the spinal cord begins. This is where the brain ends and spinal cord begins. And so where does the spinal cord go right after exiting the foramen magnum? Where does it go? Into the vertebral canal, right? If you say vertebral foramen, that would just be of C1, right? But it enters the vertebral canal. If you line up all those vertebrae, it makes a nice tunnel that we call the vertebral canal. And then, of course, here's that hypoglossal canal. One thing I didn't mention, which I think I should mention. We talked about the transverse foramina and cervical vertebrae. We talked about the vertebral foramen and each of the vertebrae, but there's another one. There's another foramen. Let's see if I see it right here. That's called the intervertebral foramen. Right, so what does inter mean? Inter means between two. So here is, and we don't see this foramen unless we put a couple vertebrae together. So here's the body of a superior vertebrae, here's the body of an inferior. We put them together, and look, we have a hole right here and right here. That's what we call the intervertebral foramen. This is how nerves leave the spinal cord, through this intervertebral foramen. And it should be nice and open like that. So if this disc, intervertebral disc, is herniated, it pushes into, or it could push into this intervertebral foramen and compress that nerve. The slide also shows something pretty nice. I see this bone or part of a vertebrae, and I see this part of a vertebrae, and I see a joint. What would you call this part of that lower vertebrae? This is the superior articulating process, right? And this right here where I have the cursor is the inferior articulating process. So inferior on the superior vertebrae, the superior process on the inferior vertebrae, and that's how they join together. Well, so you see that there are a lot of joints between vertebrae and ribs and a lot of muscles and even this intervertebral joint right here. And all of these joints have a lot of pain endings and nerve endings, so it's really not surprising that it's really easy to hurt your back, and a lot of people feel a lot of back pain all the time because all these joints, right, and muscle attachments are right here. Look at this spinous process. It almost looks like I see one point here and one point here. What kind of vertebrae would this be? That would be cervical because I see some bifid spinous process. And I can't really tell for sure if it is or not, but that would be one giveaway. I'd have to look at this transverse process. And if I look at this transverse process, if this is a cervical vertebrae, what would I see in here? I would see a hole, remember the transverse foramen, both on the right and the left transverse process. And that would for sure mean that this is a nice cervical vertebrae. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. So please sign the sign-in sheet. And then the afternoon lab, get ready for your practicum. Did anybody feel like they passed the morning practicum? Anybody pass? Yay! A lot of people did. Okay.